This episode of The Girlfriend Bracket is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. With free shipping on orders of $100 or more, a 25% buy list bonus, and their ever-popular customer rewards program, CoolStuffInc is the store for all of your Magic the Gathering needs.
Live fast, die young, bad girls do it well. Live fast, die young, bad girls do it well.
Hey everybody, this is episode number 36 of The Girlfriend Bracket. My name is Erin.
I'm Hallie.
I'm Katie.
And I'm Chris.
Katie, you're back!
I am back.
We missed you.
I missed you guys too.
Because it is the day before Thanksgiving, I can say that I am thankful that you are back with us.
Aw, that's so sweet.
Have you guys been watching Jessica Jones?
Yes.
No.
It is everything.
If you guys start it tonight and watch all of them?
Yes. Yes. It is the, I have not binge watched a show in quite a long time, and I swore that I wasn't going to binge watch this, and then it was one of those situations where before you know it, it's over. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I'm just going to queue up the next episode. Why is it taking me to another series? Oh, I want to watch tonight. Oh, shit, I just watched the whole thing in 2 days. What?
Am I going to be sad when it's over? Like, should I wait till the next season is out?
Well, I don't think you'd be sad necessarily, but it really is a good show, and it really does hit a lot of the notes that we talk about on the show. Like, there are really strong female characters that really support each other. There's, you know, interracial romance. There's lesbian relationships. They deal with post-traumatic stress and being a survivor of rape and things like that, and male-female power dynamics, diversity, just hitting all sorts of notes. And I was just really, really happy to see it. And Chris, are you finished with it yet?
I'm on episode, like, 8. I think. Okay. Nick and I had to take kind of a break. He was more excited than I was because he's a Marvel fanboy, but we've been watching it, and I'm like, good.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so if you get a chance, I highly recommend it. Yeah, all of Twitter was talking about it. Shoutouts this week. Shoutout goes out to our friend Bruce Richard, who we've talked about on the show before, and he writes the Serious Fun column on the Mothership. Bruce did a post the other day listing his favorite podcast that he personally enjoys, and on the list was our show.
Yay.
He gave us a very lovely review and told us that we had improved quite a bit since our first episodes and that we are a pleasure to listen to. We received a huge boost in iTunes placement from that plug, so thank you so much for that, Bruce. Woman of Excellence this week is our friend Amy Bailey, who lives in Oakland, California, so we will be seeing her when we go to the GP next month.
Yay.
Amy, I can't believe it's a month away.
I know.
I'm so excited. I know. Amy is the host of the Planeswalker Guide podcast, which is a show that started off being a twosome, but has now just become her own show. And she kind of reminds me of my old show, where she has people from around the community on. She has cosplayers and writers, and she gets to know them. I was on her show. She recently opened her own restaurant and gave me a really great metaphor about Sealed. Like, I mentioned that I was having a really hard time playing Sealed, and she said that one of the reasons she enjoys Sealed and why she does so well in Sealed is because she's a cook. She's a chef, and she compares Sealed to cooking. You know, having somebody give you a list of 17 ingredients and say, here, make a 3-course meal, and you're like, holy shit. You know, we couldn't do that, but she does really well in that sort of environment. And so now, you know, when I look at a recipe book, I sort of compare that to Sealed, and that's really cool. She also helped start her own chapter of the Lady Planeswalker Society in the Bay Area. Has a very healthy turnout. You can find her on Twitter at AJ Bailey, B-A-I-L-E-Y, or you can support her show at PLNSWALKER Guide on Twitter. Hot topics. This past weekend was 2 GPs. GP Kobe was in Japan. This was standard. 2 copies of Esper Dragons, 1 copy of Atarka Red, 1 Mardu, 1 Esper Tokens, 1 Blue-Green Ramp, 1 Abzan, and 1 White-Black Tokens. Atarka Red won. It was nice to see Esper Dragons get a little bit of love. The thing I noticed the most about this top 8 was the blue-green Eldrazi. Now, I know that red-green has sort of been the de facto color for a while. What do you guys think about blue-green being a possible contender for best color combination for Eldrazi ramp?
I think it seems cool. Was that the, like, mono-green rampy list that was in there?
That was the one. Let me just take a look at it here. I believe it had Dig Through Time.
and Kiora and Ugin and all that stuff in it.
Yeah, and I've actually seen several lists with a combination of blue spells. Like, some of them have been running Drowner of Hope. Adverse Conditions was another one. Clash of Wills. And, yeah, they're really spicing it up here. I even saw one with Horribly Awry.
Interesting.
Love that card.
Yeah. Now, I know, Chris, you like, you know, mono blue Tron, you know, over the red green Tron that most people pick. You know, do you think that this could work in Standard? Because it gets a lot of comparisons to being, like, the standard Tron.
For this list, you mean?
Well, yeah, because, like, you know, there's always the issue of, you know, the red-green list, red-green standard, red-green modern Tron. You know, it's all about getting the lands you need really, really fast, whereas mono-blue Tron is more about stalling with counter spells and control spells, you know, until you assemble the lands you need. You know, do you think that would carry over to, like, a standard version?
It could. I mean, I guess it depends on how they're, I guess, getting everything together. I saw the deck list for this, and it looked really awesome. Like, I would put it together, and maybe it's because of the Tron thing that it speaks to me. That could be why, but it looked really awesome. Like, I'm kind of trying to stop myself from building it so I can focus on the decks I've been building, but it looks really, really, really fun.
Yeah, it also runs four copies of Parth the Water Veil for that Awaken effect. The Lumbering Falls, which is the hexproof manland, so that's a nice little combo if you can get that together. Eight Mana Dorks, four Rattleclaw Mystics, four Leaf Gilder, Glider?
Gilder.
Gilder. it does not run any copies of Hangerback Walker, and it runs no copies of Sylvan Scrying. So I find that really appealing, just because I found those cards to be really clunky. Hallie, what do you think about this? Like, I know you and I have been playing, and you've been facing me as red-green Eldrazi. You know, as an Abzan player, what do you think about this? Like, does it improve your matchup at all?
The lack of main deck Sanctum of Ugin is actually pretty cool, because in all of our matches, as I've said to you, it's not the first Ugin that it's not the first Ulamog that kills me. It's the second one that you get after you sacrifice the Sanctum and get another one. So the inability to chain Ulamogs is definitely something that makes me feel favored. But then again, Lumbering Falls seems like it could potentially be a problem for me, because so much of my removal is targeted, especially if you put a whole bunch of counters on it and activate it so that it has hexproof. Also, Dig Through Time seems like it enables your combo, and it makes your hands very smooth. Like, if you have a rough draw, I can usually capitalize on that by just going faster than you, but if you can, you know, get a Dig Through Time and find the pieces that you need faster than I can close out the game, then it seems like you would be favored in that situation.
Yeah, I like the three Dispel on the sideboard as well, because I feel like every time I do cast an Ulamog, you have that three mana for an Abzan Charm, and it's like, damn it! And, you know, having a little bit of protection seems like it'd be really cool.
Definitely.
So, yeah. Katie, what do you think about this? Were there any other lists that appealed to you, or what do you think of blue-green Eldrazi?
I actually played, like, a Naya ramp deck at all the pre-TQs I was playing, which I'll talk about more later, but I feel like maybe this could be made stronger if it had red and it was just, like, a team release. Because it seems like, you know, if you do get, like, a slow draw, or, you know, just a draw where everything's not lining up well, you might want, like, a bit of spot removal. Because it seems like if you can't draw an Ulamog or an Ugin, you're kind of just sitting there, like, I got a lot of land, but I'm not really doing much with it. And so that might be, like, a consideration, but this deck list seems strong to me.
Yeah. There were even some lists that were running Jace, four Jace in the blue-green list. You know, Ali Antrazi's been championing that, and I'm like, oh, no, don't. One of the reasons I picked this deck was because it was reasonably affordable, so now if you throw Jace in the mix, I really can't afford this. I'm actually looking forward to getting some more time in with this deck, because I haven't been playing it as much as I want to, and there's so many things I want to try where, you know, I don't know if, you know, going with Mana Dorks is the way to go, or going without them, or if I want the offshoots in the main, or, you know, there's just so many things I want to try, and I really want to spend a lot of this weekend just grinding out games and testing all these cool things that I keep seeing. So, I did see, I know we were talking about this last week, about where Dark Jeskai is, and I have to say, many of the articles that I read this week have basically just called Dark Jeskai dead.
Yep, that was the experience that my friend David had at our PPTQ over the weekend, he played Dark Jeskai, and he's been playing it for over a month now, and he's pretty good with the deck, but he said to me afterwards that he felt like everyone was prepared for it, and like he didn't have much of a chance.
Mm. That's unfortunate, because there's just so many, you know, you think of, when you look at a deck like that, it seems to have everything, and you're like, how can a deck with all these good cards be bad? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
The breakout deck from GP Kobe was actually an Esper Soldiers deck. I don't know if you all saw this. It was basically like a black-white, things like, I think it had Bloodshin Rager. Let me just go ahead and pull this baby up here, because I know it was the talk of Twitter. So it was...
The Warrior deck.
Looks like a Warriors deck.
Correct. So they labeled it as Mardu, but it's definitely not Mardu. So it runs things like Bloodshin Rager, Mardu Strike Leader, Chief of the Edge, Bloodsoak Champion, and then Gideon, and then some Stasis Snare and Silk Wraps as sort of creature control spells, like ways to deal with creatures, 3 Valorous Dance. It looks pretty cut and dry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we really haven't seen a deck like this in a while. Like, I think it's a nice change of pace from a Tarka Red.
Yeah, this has been sort of like an FNM stalwart for a while now. A lot of, you know, casual players at the local level bringing Black-White Warriors, and occasionally it makes a little bit of a splash on a larger stage, but I think this is the first time we've seen something like that top 8.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think that this could stick? Like, could this become a thing?
I'm not sure. Radiant Flames seems like a really good answer to this deck, so I'm not really sure about that, but mm-hmm. We'll see.
Do the Abzan decks even run Languish anymore? I know that you guys were flirting with Tragic Arrogance for a while.
I do play one Tragic Arrogance in my sideboard. I haven't played Languish. It kills almost all of my creatures, so I don't really bother with it. I have thought about potentially splashing red for Radiant Flames, though, because that seems really good. So... I don't really know. Languish is definitely not on my radar right now.
Yeah, because you guys, I think it made sense when Abzan was more of like a mid-range control deck, but now that you've all sort of shifted to aggro, it does kind of seem like a non-bow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know, I was thinking about that. I saw a bunch of ramp lists, and they were like, you know, there was a black-green list on Channel Fireball that was like, 4 Languish! And I'm like, but I'm running Jotty offshoots, and why? No, like, that doesn't work. And they were just like, who cares? Just go with it. And I'm like, ooh, this is awkward. The other GP, oh man, whew, this past weekend, I'm sure you heard, was GP Pittsburgh. GP Pittsburgh suffered from some issues, which we will cover. but before we do that, it was a modern GP. The top 8 consisted of 2 copies of Blue-Red Twin, 1 copy of Jeskai Twin, 2 Affinity, 1 Green-White Aggro, like a Hate Bears kind of thing, 1 Grixis Control, 1 Titan's Scapeshift, which is like Scapeshift with Primeval Titan, so all right.
Old school.
Old school. Jeskai Twin ended up winning the whole thing. I don't really want to talk about the format too much, because not too much has changed. I really want to talk about the shit show that was GP Pittsburgh, because I was following it on Twitter and it was just madness. So here's what I can determine happened from what I've been able to see on social media. So the TO announced a cap 2 days before the GP started. So on Wednesday, they announced a cap of, I think, 2,500 people. This led to an outcry from people who felt that it was too soon, that they either deserved more notice or that they, you know, sometimes people just don't have the money right away, and you usually have until, I think, the Friday of, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So there were some people that were very caught off guard by this and were concerned that they couldn't get in. This then led to people who did pre-register offering to sell their spots. Which the TO and WotC quickly put the kibosh on, so that didn't last very long. The TO then said that they were going to have side events on Friday, which could be used for entry into the tournament. So people were going, wait a minute, girl, you said there was a cap, but yet we can still pay to get in these side events that will somehow get us into the event? So that caused some eyebrows to raise right there. And then after the fact, there were reports of side events being slow to fire. Rounds consistently went 30 minutes or more past end time. Side events were delayed while hunting for more table space. So, like, they would start a side event, and then a whole bunch of people, and then, like, the GP would really get going, and then they would have no more room. It was just a mess. Like, what did you guys think about this?
I saw a lot of judges on social media that were like, I saw one post that was like, couldn't make it to GP Pittsburgh, but looks like that was a good thing after all. It did not seem very very smooth. I did not hear a lot of positive from it, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of negative. A lot of people that have been to events run by this particular TO have said in the past it's been like the same type of deal, and if that's how they run their show, I don't want to go. Mm-hmm. I'm a little distressed by that. I'm also kind of upset that they would shove off side events to make more room for the GP, and it's like, well, some people don't come there for your main event. They want to play in the side events. Why would you get rid of something else that's going to help make you money, satisfy your customers? That seems like a really bad fucking idea.
Mm-hmm. When you guys see, you know, this laundry list of complaints, you know, people want to know who to blame. You know, everybody wants someone to blame. They want to know who to point the finger at. And it seems like there's a lot to go around. And people usually end up blaming the TO. You know, Katie, you're behind the scenes a lot at events like this as a judge, you know, and I'm not saying that you personally have to be pointing the finger, but when you see other people do that, I mean, is this Wizard's fault? Is this the TO's fault? Is this the venue's fault? How much of that is there really to go around?
I think it's kind of like a big circle of disaster. Like, I personally do not know anything about the communication with Wizards and the TOs, but, you know, the TO does get the venue and supplies the space and scopes out, you know, where it's going to be and all of that. And then they should be communicating with the judge staff, like, where it's going, you know, from there. And then some of it, like events firing slow or whatever, is sometimes on the TO's shoulders because they have people that either do registration or the judges are doing the registration. And so sometimes that can affect it. Sometimes there's not enough scorekeepers. Like, it can just be a big, big slew of things. But once they start compounding, it seems really hard to come back from them. But, you know, obviously everybody's trying their best when they're there, especially from, like, the judge staff point of view. But a lot of the blame does get put on judges, and usually it's, like, a holdup that's way up the line of command that nobody can really fix. That seems to be a big issue.
Well, I've also heard of judges being able to sort of stem the bleeding. Like, I remember when I was at GP Richmond, and that was the big modern tournament that Star City Games held, and there were some, you know, there was some messiness behind the scenes because there was record turnout for that event, and I can remember certain judges that were able to, you know, sort of, you know, there were things going on behind the scenes that aren't normally the purview of the judges, but they were still able to get their hands dirty and kind of fix them. So the judges mm-hmm. can make a difference. I'm not saying they're to blame, but I'm saying they can help, you know, if things are really getting out of hand.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. The other debacle regarding this event had to do with the bathrooms, and there was a lot of kerfuffle about this, a lot of conflicting information, and I tried to get the most accurate picture that I could. So here's what I was able to determine. So there were three blocks of bathrooms on the first floor of the GP, and then I know this because I looked at the floor plan, and there was also a sketch that somebody showed me of a picture that was found in the artist alley. And what I mean by blocks is a set of men's and women's bathrooms. So there were initially three men's and three women's, all total. Eventually, two of those women's rooms were converted to men's rooms. So then that put it at five men's and one women's on that floor. Then a family bathroom, which is usually that single, it's oftentimes used as like a handicap bathroom, has a changing station and things like that. That was eventually converted to a women's room as well. So then we had like 1.25 bathrooms. At some point, it was reported that the lock broke on that bathroom. I don't know if it started broken or if it ended up broken, but there were numerous reports that that bathroom had a broken lock. And this led to a lot of outrage from women on social media. There was one woman who got really, really angry, like, at the event and, like, got in people's faces. And, you know, there were just a lot of women that were like, you know, this is a bad deal. You know, like, we feel like we're not wanted here. This is consistently happening. What do you all think about this practice of converting bathrooms that we consistently see at these big events?
It's bullshit. I'm not happy with it at all. Yeah. I understand that, you know, the argument is made that there are disproportionately more men than there are women at the event. I understand that. But there are lots of other types of events that happen at convention centers where there is a gender imbalance where bathrooms are not repurposed like this. So I don't think that's a valid excuse. I think we need, you know, the same number of bathrooms just for convenience sake. And, you know, if you are a woman at a tournament and you are in a situation like this, I've been in this situation because when I went to a GP about a year and a half ago, there was a women's bathroom that was repurposed as a men's bathroom, and there were only two bathrooms in the hall, the entire hall. If you wanted to go to a women's bathroom, you had to go all the way to the other side of the convention center, which was a pain in the neck, to say the least, especially when you're playing Esper Control and you have a small bladder. Anyway, so what I did in that situation was I talked to a judge and I asked, who is the tournament organizer in charge of this event? And by tournament organizer, I don't mean Channel Fireball, Star City Games, like a larger event. There is a judge, usually a senior level judge, who is appointed the TO for the event. And if you ask to speak to that person, you can give feedback directly to that person. And that's what I did. And that person, you know, had the bathrooms reassigned and had them cleaned up and turned them back into women's bathrooms, which was great. And I would, you know, I would suggest that if this happens again, that, you know, people continue to raise this issue because it is an issue. It needs to be addressed. But I do hope that this just stops happening.
Yeah, the issue I have with this is sort of in line with yours, Hallie, where it's like, you know, if you look at, you know, other environments where the gender is skewed, this doesn't happen. You know, if you go to a sports game, which is overwhelmingly male, you don't see them converting the women's room to men's rooms. Oh. Likewise, on the opposite side, if you go to, say, a One Direction concert, or you go to a women's leadership conference, you don't see them converting the men's room into women's. They make the women wait. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't see that. If you go to a tech conference, you know, unfortunately, the tech world is still largely, you know, male dominated. You know, you don't see them converting bathrooms. I feel like we only see this here. And it's like, you know, okay, I could understand converting a bathroom. That's fine. But like when you had five and we had one and the family bathroom, which may or may not have had a broken lock, that's a really poor message. And I don't think it means that like Wizards doesn't want women to play. I don't think it's anything so obvious. I think it's more of like a microaggression where it's just sort of a symptom of the greater problem. You know, it just seems like it's really poor planning, you know, to build off what Katie said, the circle of disaster. It's like, you know, I'd like to think that next year things will get better by running less events, by actually instituting the caps and being firm with that. I would like to think that maybe this will happen less if we do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like, I guess maybe I'm in a less favorable camp where I don't really mind if there's a disproportionate amount of bathrooms for women to men, because sometimes the numbers are so vastly skewed in Magic that, you know, if there's five women at a 2,000 person GP, I don't need to pee in 20 different stalls all at once. Like, I don't mind, you know, having one bathroom. I do, like Hallie said, where she went to a GP where it was like all the way on the other side of the convention center. I don't think that women's bathrooms should be out in the boonies, so we have to walk farther than everybody else to go potty. But when I was in Denver, they made like the only women's bathroom into a men's, and I didn't realize until after I'd gone in there that it was now a men's and not a women's. And there was, like, no other women's bathroom, like, anywhere. So I was just like, hey, guys, I gotta pee. I'm coming in here because it had my name on the door first. So I'm not gonna go anywhere else. But I guess I don't really mind if there's a disproportionate amount of bathrooms. But I think that it should be planned out well in advance. Like, if they expect X numbers, they should have X number of bathrooms for how many men they expect and how many women they expect. And it shouldn't be changed throughout the weekend. So, like, maybe this bathroom is a men's now, maybe it's a woman's now. Who knows? But, like, I don't see a huge problem with the numbers of bathrooms, as long as it's well announced. And I feel like they should be planning for it more than they are, and that's where the big hiccup is at.
Yeah, you're right. And that was the issue, too, is like, you know, the women, there were some women who didn't even know about that bathroom in the main hall. Like, there were women tweeting and saying, both of our bathrooms have been converted. We're only aware of the family bathroom. And then the TO was like, well, wait a minute, girl, there's this one women's room that's still here. But I guess it didn't have, like, the, you know, how sometimes there are these signs, like, popping out of the wall that say restroom, or, like, the signs on top of the doors. You know, just some better visual indicators to imply that there's a bathroom there. I was under the impression, based on Twitter, that like that wasn't obvious. So, like, there were women in the main hall, and maybe there were so many people in the main hall, they were like, we didn't even know there was a bathroom here. Like, you know, we knew that our two in the lobby had been taken away, or that the one in the main and the one in the lobby was gone, but we didn't even know about this third bathroom. So I think you're right. You know, it was just a case of, like, generally poor planning. And just poor communication. And I hope that, you know, having less events next year will mean that you can really put those resources towards improving that.
Yeah, for sure.
The other thing I was really perturbed by was just some of the ways that, you know, some dudes chose to respond to this, you know, by, you know, there were women like Mrs. Mulligan, for example. You know, she was the one who tweeted a picture of one of the bathrooms and shared her feelings. And, you know, when people say that they're feeling a certain way, the last thing they want to hear is policy, procedures, guidelines, you know. And so there were women, there were multiple women that were like, you know, I am bothered by this. Like, I don't feel wanted. I don't like that my bathroom has a broken lock. And people were coming back and saying, well, per policy of 8.56 blah, the bathroom doesn't have to blah. And it's like, that's not what people want to hear. Like, you know, the professor today, he posted a really good article or retweeted an article about listening. Like, just listening to someone when they're saying, I'm having an issue, I feel a certain way, not rushing in and being the first to comment or just wanting to be right, just saying nothing and going, I hear you. You know, I think that's really what some people needed in that situation, and I don't think they got that, because I was seeing too many people jumping into the fray to, well, the TO was quoted as this, but the venue can't provide this. And it's like, that's not what people want to hear. You know, yeah. And like, you think you're helping, but that's really like salt in the wound, where it's like, you know, I was a mortgage collector for 2 years, and it's like, you know, when people are falling behind on their mortgages and they're getting collection phone calls, you know, they don't want to hear, well, you signed a contract, you should know that you need to pay your mortgage. No, you don't do that. Like, at some point, you need to inject a little empathy in the conversation, and that was something that was really lacking from what I saw.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are just making stupid comments and being like, this is about numbers and blah blah blah. It's like, no, it's not about numbers.
Yeah, Kai, I love Kai dearly, but Kai tried pulling out with me. He's like, you know, I'm pretty sure that your 1.5 bathrooms had more space than the five. And I'm like, all right, girl. I was like, I'm not Tim Taylor. Like, I'm not good with the tape measure, but let's not do this. Like, let's not say that my 1.10 bathroom had more. Get out of here. Like, I'm not even going to entertain that. Like, whatever, girl. So. So, also this past weekend, Hallie and Katie, you two have been on a bit of a PPTQ tear lately. I've been keeping up with you both on social media, top aiding all the PPTQs, it seems.
Trying.
I think you're doing really well. Like I said that on the last show, I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
But I noticed that you two, no shade, you know, you are coming up against that stumbling block of, you know, you're getting the top eight, and then for whatever reason, you're not able to seal the deal. So, you know, how is this making you two feel? Like, walk us through what's going through your minds right now.
For me, I definitely try to find ways to improve, or, you know, I try to analyze what happened and think about, okay, what went wrong here. So the week before last, I played in a limited PPTQ, where I made top four, which was pretty good. Because in the past I've made top eight and then immediately lost in the quarterfinals. This time I actually won my quarterfinal, which was pretty cool. I also made top eight with a pool that was really terrible. it was a really tough pool with lots of like niche cards that didn't really fit together very well. So I was just like, okay, I have two sheer drops. I'll just play blue white flyers. It'll be fine. And I think I played well enough to sort of compensate for how bad my pool was. And then in the top eight draft, like, I think I did pretty well considering that I had never drafted at competitive REL before, with, like, the judge telling you, like, pick up the pack, you have 45 seconds or whatever. But I definitely didn't make... I made some good picks. I also made some bad picks. So that's more of, like, a learning experience. Like, okay, maybe I undervalued this card because I passed two copies of this card that I thought was bad to my opponent, and then he killed me with them. So that's a learning experience. So that's sort of what I took away from the limited tournament, and I do think I'm a better limited player than I am a constructed player, so it makes sense to me that, you know, I would do better in that tournament, and that I would have, like, more micro lessons to take away from it rather than, like, bigger macro lessons. For the standard one, It was really surreal because I won my first three matches and then lost my next three, which was really weird. Like, I don't think I dropped a game in the first three matches. And I went against some pretty tough decks, too. Like, I played the Abzan Mirror, and then I played against Esper Control, which I don't believe is a good matchup for me. But my opponent kind of stumbled on mana and got a little unlucky, maybe kept a hand that he shouldn't have. I just sort of lost the last three matches. And it was all just because, even though I spent so much time playing on Magic Online, I kind of neglected, you know, my local community. I turned down a couple of invitations to come to people's, you know, casual standard night so that I could play on Magic Online. And then those people who invited me to their casual standard night ended up beating me with decks that I was unfamiliar with. So I feel like, you know, my sort of zealous pursuit of Magic Online may have been, I don't know, I think it will help me in the long run, but I think I need to not necessarily lose sight of what my local meta is like also.
Yeah, I had very mixed feelings over those 7 days. So the last weekend when I had played two PBTQs back-to-back, I lost one match of my first one and then was able to draw in eventually. And then I played that same person in the top eight, and we both agreed that the matchup was very much in my favor. And I lost again in the quarterfinals. So it was like, if I could have picked somebody to play in the top eight, I probably would have picked that deck to play against, but still lost to it. So I was playing a Naya Dragon ramp Eldrazi deck where it's playing like Explosive Vegetation, Rattleclaw, Ulamog, Ugin, but then it's also playing Dragon Lord Atarka and Dragon Lord Dromoka, which were just very, very good for me all weekend. I had never played a game with it before round one, so we kind of just went in swinging, but so after that top eight, they were just starting the first round of the next one, so I snuck into that one. And I lost to a green-red landfall, like, aggro deck, which I think also should have been a good matchup for me, like, with how my deck was situated and with my Dragon Lord Atarkas being able to, you know, kill off, like, three guys in one turn. But it just didn't really go my way in the Swiss, and then I ended up making top eight anyway, and then I played him in the quarters, and then I lost to him again, as is the way with Magic. But so that day, I mean, I don't know, I posted a status update on Facebook that was like, top eight of two PPTQs today, like, proud, but, you know, wish I could actually win one. And Frank Lepore commented, and he's like, that's still very good. And I thought about that comment for a long time, and I was like, it is good, but it's so frustrating to spend all of that time. Like, I don't know if it's better to make top eight and, like, lose, or, you know, lose in the finals, or if it's better to just go, like, 0-2 drop and do something with the rest of your day. But I got a lot of reps in, and then this last Saturday, I played the same deck. I made just a very, very small tweak to it. And it was five rounds cut to top four. We only had 15 people, so instead of cutting to top eight, they do a top four cut. And I made it into top four, and I had played one person, the same person I had played last weekend in the first PBTQ that I lost to, and I lost to him again on a different deck. And then I played him first round in top four and lost to him again. So four out of four matches that I've played him in the last, you know, that was like a 7 day span I had lost to him, but he's a player I really respect in Montana, so I'm really glad he ended up winning this last one. So he will be going to the RPTQ, but it's really, I don't know, it's hard. I was like telling my mom, you know, all of this stuff, and she's like, oh, you should be proud of yourself, honey, like, that's really good. And I'm like, Mom, it doesn't matter. Winning is the only thing that matters. And she's like, yeah, but that's still something to be proud of. And it's just, it's hard for me to be proud and be disappointed in the same time, I guess, because it feels like I feel like I have enough skill to win, but then it just, it doesn't happen. And I was really frustrated after this last one, and of course Brooke gets to hear all my frustrations, but, you know, after a while, after I just accepted it, and I was like, it'll happen one day. This just wasn't my week. Maybe in February, I wasn't meant to go. Maybe it'll be bad roads, and I won't even be able to get there anyway. But it's difficult. I don't know. It's good that I'm being consistently decent, but I am kind of disappointed that it just never gets there. Always the bridesmaid.
Yeah, it's hard because the nature of the tournament, I think, is what makes it kind of difficult, because it's sort of like, you know, the player who finishes first gets the invite and everyone else sort of gets nothing. Or, I mean, in some game stores, you know, you'll get prizes for top eight. They sort of vary from store to store. But in general, like, if you don't win a PPTQ or you don't win a PTQ or whatever, like, your goal is to get on the Pro Tour, and anything short of that goal kind of feels like a letdown. So it's tough. I mean, I would say that, you know, putting up consistent results does mean something. I think it does show improvement, and it does show that, you know, we're on the right track, obviously. Like, we're doing consistently well with a certain deck or in a certain format, and it means, you know, that there might be a win in our future. I don't know, but it is really tough to deal with in the short term.
Yeah. And I'm sorry if my question came off as shitty at all. What I was trying to say is, like, you know, when you're going to these events, you know, I'm very protective of my friends. And so when you do well, I root for you. And when you don't do well, I feel that too, you know? And so when I was seeing Hallie, you mentioned getting, you know, some consolation ice cream, and, you know, Katie mentioned the feeling of always being a bridesmaid, you know, I felt bad along with you, and I wanted to do something, and there was nothing I could do. And so, you know, I was feeling that right along with you.
Oh. Yeah. No, I didn't take your question as okay. shitty at all. I was, however, really proud of my endurance during my double header PPTQ, because I played 13 rounds of Magic, and I was, like, focused and intense the whole time, and I didn't really feel any fatigue until after I lost in top 8, and then I was like, oh, my throat hurts, and I'm just going to go to sleep on the floor. Like, I don't feel good at all. We didn't leave there until, like, 2 or 3 in the morning, and we got home, and I had to work at 9, so I was like, But I was, like, I drank a lot of water, and throughout the day, I was like, the girls would be so proud of me, because we talk about this on the show, and I was like, I ate good food, and I did not know that I had it in me to be that hyper alert, but I felt like my adrenal gland was really pumping out some adrenaline that whole day.
So I think I missed that. So did you say that this was in the same day? Like, you literally went from one PPTQ at the same store immediately into another at the same store?
Yep. They had rented out a small hotel convention room thing. And so the first one started at 11, and we drove over there that morning. And then the second one started basically when this one had cut to top 8, the first one. But they didn't get going fast enough. They were, I don't know, having technical difficulties or something. And our match went pretty fast, so I got to sneak in there without a round one loss. So, yeah, it was all back-to-back.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. Like, I couldn't do that.
So. Yeah. At the end of the day, I kind of regretted it. But throughout the day, I was doing great.
Well, like I want to reiterate, you know, when we started this topic, you know, I'm very proud of you, and I'm pretty sure Chris feels the same way, and our listeners feel the same way. So, you know, I just want you two to keep plugging at it, because I do believe you two have what it takes.
We'll get there one day, Hallie.
Yeah,
we will.
And then you'll reach a point where it's like, we're on the Pro Tour, guys. We can't record your little show anymore. Sorry. It's like, oh, excuse me.
And then I'll be like, all I can do is top 8 Pro Tours, but I can't win that.
And me and Chris will just be tapping our pen like, yeah, we same.
Rough life. Right.
It's a hard knock life. The last topic of the day comes from our friend Saffron Olive over at MTG Goldfish, and he wrote a very polarizing article about legacy. The topic of legacy has been coming up a lot lately. You know, there have been rumors of the death of legacy and how, you know, what next year is going to hold for the format. And he proposes something that he thinks could help the format. One of the things that people like to point to for why Legacy, you know, can't sustain itself is the reserve list, which is basically a list that Wizards came up with as and promised that they would never reprint these cards, partially so that people could keep their value, and partially just because the cards were so powerful, they didn't really know what they would do to other formats. And some people think that the reserve list should be abolished, and some people think that would be terrible. And so Saffron came up with like a happy medium of basically saying, all right, well, if you can't reprint what's on the reserve list, and you're not going to abolish the reserve list, why don't we just ban everything that's on the reserve list? And that way, that will take away some of the more expensive staples that keep people from playing Legacy. And then he wrote an article about what would happen to the format if these staples went away. Chris, as somebody who's trying to save up for Legacy herself, you know, what did this mean to you? Like, do you think that this would be helpful to you to get into the format, or what do you think?
Well, when I started reading the article, I was like, okay, like, I could get behind this, but the deck that I would want to make would be, like, completely unplayable. if things were, like, changed around, there'd be no more Tabernacle, the lands in there would go away, and I'm trying to build lands. And when I'm reading it, and it's like, Lion's Eye Diamond, and I'm like, oh, shit, that fucks over Aaron's dredge deck.
I sent that young man a tweet today, because I didn't read the article today, and I was like you, I was reading this, and I'm like, oh, yeah, girl, get rid of them lands. I don't need them lands. And I'm like, oh, yeah. And then you're like, I heard the record stop, and then I was like, oh, well, my deck can totally survive. I don't need that card. And then he specifically says, and I quote, I think most of us would agree Legacy would survive just fine without the premier graveyard deck in the format. Everyone knows Dredge was a mistake.
I know. Shots fired.
I read that and I'm like, oh god, I'm sure like a piece of Erin's soul like died like when she read that. And she was like, oh, hell no, you didn't say that. And
I was like, oh, I sent that young man a tweet and I was like, listen. I was like, all you need to do is retract it and I will leave the Colombian drug cartel out of this. One phone call.
But
you were saying, Chris.
Oh, yeah. It was just like, oh, and I'm like, well, maybe I don't want this then. And like, I appreciate him like breaking all this shit down because I could not have done that. I like how he went, you know, buy certain cards to be like, well, if this comes out, then these decks are less powerful, but then it gives these decks a chance to shine. And, you know, what's going to be, you know, slower or faster, you know, if this did happen. And I was like, okay, so it seems like it would do some good things, but also some bad things at the same time. And I just don't know if, you know, there's another deck I'd want to play. Land seems fun, and without, you know, the essential cards that it needs, it would be non-existent. And then he mentioned that combo would not work anymore, which is kind of sad. So, like, I don't know. I understand, you know, it would maybe give Wizards an incentive to help support Legacy more, but I mean, have they ever actually, like, made a statement about how they feel about Legacy, like, at all?
Not like we would define a statement. You know, people like to read into, you know, how many GPs Legacy gets. Like, Legacy only has one American GP next year. The other GP is in Europe, and the other GP is in Japan. So there's only three Legacy GPs next year. So people like to look at that as sort of their statement, where they are slowly pulling more support from it. So,
because that's the other thing. Like, I wish that, you know, not that they have to, like, officially say whether or not they support it or they don't, but, you know, just some kind of
sign.
Yeah, just that they're like, hey, we know how much people like or appreciate Legacy. Like, I know this is unrelated, but, like, I think about even, like, the Star City game nights that they started to do, you know, where they're giving out pins and other things. I wish there was something that, like, Wizards could do for Legacy, like, as an incentive to have people get more into the game. I mean, I get that a lot of the lands are expensive. Unfortunately, because of the reserve list, they can't reprint certain things, and so I get that. But I don't even know if I'd really quote unquote want them reprinted? Like, if they're reprinted, are they only playable in Legacy? Or, you know, what happens from there? He talked about how you could put the Shocklands in instead of using the dual lands and everything, and like kind of breaks down the price difference. But as someone that doesn't actively play Legacy, I don't know if it would feel even like the same. Like, I don't know if that makes sense to say, yeah. But or it, would it be like we're just playing Modern Light, quote unquote, or something? So
we would
I don't
be
know.
Taking we would be taking a lot of damage off of our lands. Let's just put it that way.
Happy, yeah. What do you think about this? You know, the idea of, you know, taking a little something from every deck and possibly completely, you know, shelving certain decks for the sake of an entire format. Like, do you think that's reasonable?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I mean, it's definitely an interesting thought experiment, and I was actually going through the reserved list and seeing which cards were going to be gone, and it's not that many. But the few cards that are going to be banned, that would theoretically be banned, are very influential. I mean, other than the lands, you know, there are a lot of cards that make specific decks work. You know, there are little cards you wouldn't think of, like Humility. Humility, yeah, would be gone. All these random things. I mean, the defining cards of the format, as I see it, are still, you know, Brainstorm and Wasteland, which would still be around, but the format wouldn't be as diverse as it is now, and I think it's the diversity of the format that makes it so attractive to a lot of Legacy players. You know, the ability to play a wacky combo deck like Alurin and top 8 a GP, or, you know, play Mud, or play Storm, or, you know, whatever. There are so many great Legacy decks. Another thing that I thought of, I looked on MTG Goldfish, they have a sort of chart with all the prices of specific cards in each format, and you can sort of see how those prices go up and down over time. One thing that I noticed was that, you know, a lot of the most expensive cards in Legacy are on the reserve list, you know, the dual lands, Tabernacle, things like that. However, this wouldn't immediately fix the problem of the format being expensive. Many of the most expensive cards in the format are, you know, things like Caracas, Rishadan Port, Show and Tell, Jace the Mind Sculptor. A lot of cards hovering around 100, even up in around like $100 to $200 range. So I don't know that the format would necessarily be more affordable unless those cards were reprinted, but I also don't see a card like Caracas being reprinted in a standard legal set anytime soon. So I'm not really sure what the fix is. Like, I think it would alleviate some of the, you know, the financial barriers that people face trying to get into Legacy, but not all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a chart here, or a table, that talks about, you know, the top decks in the format, what they currently cost, and if this were to take place, how the costs would be affected. And Miracles, for example, which is probably the best deck in the format right now, some most would say, right now, if you were to build Miracles, it costs about $2,861.
Only.
No big. If this were to take place and the reserve list were to be banned, it would take $611 off of the cost, which means you're still paying $2,250. So you can say that that's like a 30% savings or a 40% savings, but it ends up being a drop in the bucket when your debt costs $2,800. Mm-hmm. Shardless Bug, for example, $3,622 to build that. If the reserve list ban were to happen, that would shave about $1,400 off and leave you with a final total of $2,100. So I think you're right. You're still having to pay for, you know, the Lilianas, the Tarmogoyfs, the Death Rites, you know, the Ancestral Visions or whatever, and every Baleful Strix and all that nonsense. And just, it's, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's a nice idea in theory. And I have to say, it's like, you know, for as much as I love Dredge, I have to say that if it means I would get to play the format more, I would take the hit. I mean, you know, because I really do love the format. And if it means I have to, you know, maybe invest in something else, I would do it. I just don't like seeing, you know, I see the love that people have for these Eternal formats. Like, you know, I see the love that people have for Vintage and for Legacy, and to see that entire community just disappear and to see a format disappear really sucks. And so if I have to, you know, go through something in order to, not to sound heroic or anything, but if I have to go through some hard times in order for a format I love to prosper, I would do it.
The whole time I was reading this article, I was like, I mean, besides where he was like, control would get worse and burn would get better, I was like, oh god. But for the rest of it, I was like, why not both? Like, I feel like it obviously wouldn't be a huge drastic, like, we have Legacy 2.0 and then we have, like, Original Legacy. But I feel like we could support both of them. Like, for people, you know, like Aaron or, like, most Legacy players who have invested in one deck and really love that deck and want to play it, like, I feel like why can't we support that Legacy but also have, like, a kind of newer Legacy where people who are just getting into the format who haven't already invested in all of the lands and all of this stuff that they need to get their certain deck could play like this kind of Legacy. Like, I don't see why that would be a huge deal. Like, if this became its own format, then you could have it for FNMs and all sorts of things that people could not get any lands or, you know, any of that stuff, but could still make a deck and play and have fun without having to have like a proxy tournament that can't be put into the DCI sanctioning, you know, reporter. But I feel like we could just have both and everybody would be happy.
It could be like modern no band list, except
I was
like
just thinking that.
Like mm-hmm. Legacy extra band list.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if it's something that could support its own like GPs or opens or things like that, but I think Hallie brought up a really good point. You know, I think it is something that could still be, you know, a neat weekend thing where you could still get 45, 50 people to come out for it. It still could technically be sanctioned. There's the no modern ban list, are those sanctioned?
No, they can't
okay,
be.
Oh, that's right. Mm. But I mean, the price support for those isn't shabby.
Mm-mm.
Okay. So, I mean, there's still ways to, even if it's not sanctioned, to still have a popular tournament with good prize support. You know, I think you're right. You know, you could have both. I just don't think it would be its own, you know, format, quote unquote, as we know it.
Yeah.
But I like it as an idea.
Mm-hmm.
So. Listener question this week. Be sure to send your questions to thegirlfriendbracket@gmail.com. This question comes to us from Susie. And Susie says, hi, girls. I just found out about your podcast, and it has been a blast listening to all of them backwards. Yes, backwards, she says. I tuned in somewhere last month and proceeded to download the other episodes in reverse order all the way to the first. Well, that's awesome. A while back, I heard a story. I'm not sure about the authenticity of the story, but it moved me. Brian Brown-Dewin played in a tournament where he was matched up against a 12-year-old kid who's been playing well but never made it into the top 8. We can relate. Out of compassion, Brian decided to concede so that the kid could advance, placing himself into 9th place. Have you ever been moved to compassion by your opponent? Have you ever decided to act differently in the interest of the emotional well-being of your foe? It dawns on me that I would have a hard time to compete seriously against Maya Carroll, a survivor of stage 4 cancer and prominent Magic player, or just my friend who's had a really tough week at work. Please take care. Susie.
So her two examples there at the end, kind of, I know that she means them in a good way, but I feel like it's kind of the same thing when somebody, you know, plays against me at FNM. It's like, I'm going to go easy on you because you're a girl. is kind of what I thought of when she said that. But maybe in a more casual setting, like at FNM or something, I've definitely, you know, gone easier on somebody who's new or, you know, just so the game can go on a little bit longer so they don't feel like, oh, wow, that wasn't any fun to lose on turn 3 or whatever. But in a competitive format, I don't have empathy. I'm a cold-hearted bitch. I don't fuck around with that competitive business. So, no. My answer is a slow no.
Yeah, I'm with Katie on this in a lot of senses. I mean, I'm also a very competitive person. Like, if we're playing a competitive REL, like, I'm going to play my best and hope my opponent plays their best, too, and sort of leave it at that. I also took issue with the examples that the letter writer used, just because, I mean, not to get super personal, but, I mean, I've definitely played in tournaments after recovering from like serious health issues. Like I had surgery once and then I ended up playing in a PTQ like 5 days after that. And, you know, it was kind of obvious because I was not as mobile as I normally am. And so I had to be placed at table one for the entire tournament. And so everyone who came up to me knew that there was something a little weird because I was just at this one table for the entire tournament. And I wasn't winning all of my matches. But, you know, we had good games and they treated me like any other person. And that was all that I really wanted, was to be treated like everyone else in the room. And so I, you know, if I were in that position, I would not feel comfortable if my opponent, you know, went easy on me because I had something outside the game that, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say, but it's definitely different at regular REL. I know, I've played against people at Lady Planeswalker Society sometimes, and you know, if we sort of do a pack per win system, so if we get a draw, then nobody gets a pack. And there have been a couple of times when I've unintentionally drawn a match with someone, and I've just said, you know what, I'll concede to you, so you get the pack. Like mm-hmm. It means more to you than it does to me. So you know, here, have a win. But at competitive, that's not really my thing.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing because of just like there are times when I could see, oh yeah, I wouldn't be that way, but then there's times that, and you guys know, I've helped my opponent or given them pointers, because part of me is just like, but wait a second, you know, I guess it depends on where we're at. Like if we're at a more competitive tournament, if I'm doing well, hell no, all bets are fucking off. If we're just whatevering at the last table, I don't even give a shit anymore. You know, I want you to be better, and I would hope that you want me to be better. But taking, like, I don't know, quote unquote, like, pity on somebody because they, you know, are sick or they have been sick or whatever, they want to be done with that part of their life. They want to move on from the things that have, you know, caused them stress in the past. And especially, like, somebody had cancer, who wants to be the person everybody feels sorry for because they had cancer? They beat cancer. Fuck cancer. You know, they're beyond that now. They just want to play Magic the fucking Gathering. So, you know, I look at that with, like, anything else. You know, I wouldn't want to feel like someone was giving me, like, a pity win. Because then I'd be like, this just feels gross and wrong. So, yeah, I would say mostly, I guess, no mercy. Especially if it was like Nick, I could never let Nick win. And funny enough, at the last FNM that we were both at, we had to play each other, and he just conceded to me outright. He's like,
"Oh man,
yeah." He's like, "I don't want to ruin your night," and I'm like, "It's okay." I'm like, "We just do not have a good time playing together." I'm like, "I get that," and he's like, "I would rather have you be happy than ruin your night." I'm like, "We can play, and I'm fine." And he's like, "No." So in that instance, you know, Nick would rather have me be happy, and that certainly has prerogative, but I would never talk him into that. And we both amicably agreed to that. But if it was someone that wasn't him that was just like, here, you know, you take the win for some, like, weird reason, I'd be like, probably not. We should probably play this out. But if someone's going to leave, and even, like, in Hallie's example, if someone, you know, could get a pack, if someone could obtain something from it, and, you know, it's kind of like a no big deal type of thing, I could completely understand if you were like, hey, you know what, you have a better chance of getting in, or you're going to get this prize or this kind of incentive. I have no issue with letting you get the win for that. In that situation, I'm perfectly fine with it. But competitive REL seems like a bad idea.
See, you handle that better than I would. Like, that's a really hot topic, you know, the idea of scooping for your partner, and particularly when it comes to men scooping for their women, that topic always gets people in a tizzy. I have to say, I'd be mad if my guy did that. Like, I would literally be like, what, you know, you're going to secure, and you're going to fight me, and we're going to do this. Like, I would be mad, I have to say, if my guy tried to do that. Like, I'm not faulting your guy for doing that, but, you know, if I had a guy that was just like, oh, I just want you to be happy. No, like, we're going to tussle, damn it. Like, that's something I would not handle very well. And, you know, the more I think about it, I don't know if that's my own pride talking or if that's just simply a result of the conversations that I've had other people have where, like, I would feel, part of me would look at that and kind of, like, I'd be worried what other people would say where it's like, ooh, Erin Campbell had to get her man to scoop for her. Like, I would feel kind of obligated to, like, put on that show of, I don't need a man to scoop for me. Sit down. We're going to do this. And you mentioned that. That's a really hot button issue.
Sorry, I'm laughing because I'm just thinking of the thing from the Leaving a Legacy podcast where they're like, you don't even have to scoop to anyone, not even your mom. And like, that's just what it makes me think of. Because like, we were going to play, but then he was also worried I would kick his ass because he was playing Dark Jeskai and I had been like rocking face with like my other decks. And I'm like, all right, sounds good to me.
Yeah, I have to admit, I wouldn't have handled that well. I probably would have said some unpleasant things, like, not for this podcast, of course, but, you know, I do think of myself as, you know, when I'm in a relationship, I do think of myself as being equals with the guy, and it's like, you know, I'd want to know that we could have it out, and that it would be honorable and respectful, and I don't know, I would just feel... I would have a hard time looking at my boyfriend the same if he did that, but that's just me. So, in terms of compassion at large, you can't play the decks that I play and have compassion for people. When you sign up to play Ad Nauseam and Dredge, you leave that shit at the door because you're just a terrible person. And I've come to accept that, and I know that, and that's fine. But no, I will say, though, that I do have that problem of not being able to defeat certain kinds of people. I've said it before, I have a really hard time playing children, especially if they're cute. I can't do it. Where, you know, I'll see some cute child with puffy cheeks and blue eyes, and like, ugh, I can't kill you. Like, I just can't do it. And I agonize over that. And I do remember there was one time at F&M where there was a young man in a wheelchair, and he was doing really, really well, and I was doing really well, and it looked like we were going to be paired against each other. And I'll admit that I was a little uncomfortable with that, where it was simply me going, if I beat the guy in a wheelchair, I'm going to be that girl who beat the guy in the wheelchair, and oh God. And like, I just felt really bad about that. And I that's my issue, and I freely admit that. But that's something I've never really gotten over, where I would feel it's certainly not their fault. It's entirely me. I can't stress that enough. But, you know, I would feel like I would need to maybe pull the punch, or like I would need to hold back. And I'm not really sure how to get over that. And you guys have certainly brought up good points, and maybe that will help me. But I've had that issue in the past where I feel the need to go easy on certain types of people. And I don't quite know how to beat that. But so
I do want to let it be known that while I am a cold-hearted bitch, I am logical, like, in a competitive scene. Like, if somebody got paired down to me and I had, like, no chance of making top 8 or something, or prizes or whatever, I would concede. And I just want to let it be known that, you know, I'm rational while cold.
There is a line somewhere, and Katie stands on the right side of it.
Yes.
That's your official, PSA.
Yes.
She had to add that just in case somebody was listening to the show and they were like, oh, that's that Katie Neal. She don't drop for no one. And
yeah, I didn't want somebody to be like, she's 0-3 in this 4-round tournament. She's just going to be calling the judge and trying to loot rules lawyer, which I don't do anyway. But, you know, I don't want that. I don't want that on my record. So
that's fine.
Putting it out there so I have a clear conscience going in tomorrow. There you
go. Clear the air. any final thoughts before we wrap up the show? Well, I just want to say that we are in the midst of working on our Patreon, which we're very excited about. We've had several listeners who say that they want to support the show by tossing us a couple dollars here and there. And so we've been hard at work at coming up with our milestone goals, you know, some really cool things that we can offer you all for supporting us, and also some tier rewards as well. Some of the things that we've been talking about is thank you notes from our dogs, like Watson and Kirby. We've also been talking about some merch, like stickers and t-shirts, and some rare offers to draft with us on Magic Online, to have exclusive Google Hangouts with us. So we're really looking forward to bringing that to you all, and hopefully you will consider supporting us in the near future. So, if anybody's enjoyed listening to the show, how can they find us, and how can they get a hold of us?
So I'm Hallie. You can find me on Twitter at HalCanSan. That's H-A-L-C-A-N-S-A-N. You can read my Tumblr, which is magicandrealism.tumblr.com, and you can find my writing here on gatheringmagic.com.
And I'm Katie, and if you still want to follow me after listening to this show, my Twitter is @meanmugger, that's MEANMUGGER. You can find me by email at katie.neil14@gmail.com.
And I'm Chris. My Twitter is @THKRIZ. My Gmail is YOTHKRIZ, that's Yo to Chris. And my Snapchat is Cryptic Command with K's. I've been getting some awesome pics. You guys all rock.
Did Katie send you a picture?
It's on the way.
I was waiting for it. I was leering at my phone.
There it is. Just sent.
And I'm Erin. You can find me on Twitter at Original Estrus. That is ORIGINALOESTRUS. You can email me personally at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Follow us on Twitter. The show is at the GF Bracket, and you can email us at thegirlfriendbracket@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening. Have a wonderful Turkey Day, and we will talk to you all next week. Bye.